8 minutes past 10 o'clock in the world's greatest city. Phil Manekian for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Of course, the big news of the week is the election. Quite a few issues. I'd like to cover some of those, if we can, with the help of Vic Vaughn. Vic, you're like doing overtime tonight, man.
Getting my work in for sure.
Make sure you put overtime on your time card. Okay,
okay, I will do that. Yeah, I'm sure that'll work out just fine.
I'll back you up on that 100%. Now, my numbers that I have, there were 120 ballot measures in 32 states on Tuesday. So a lot going on. Some of the biggest ones were legalizing marijuana. That was huge.
And some states who wanted it to pass were very happy right now.
Yeah, this is very true. New Jersey was one of them. My numbers say that it passed by 2/3.
And that's an interesting one, because you know what I thought when I first saw New Jersey got their, the voters approved it there? It's right next to New York.
Yep.
And it makes me wonder, are they next?
Right, right. They don't have it yet, right?
Not statewide, no.
Okay. And I think all of these are for 21 and over, right?
Exactly, 21 and over.
Okay.
Yeah.
Arizona passed it as well.
Yeah, there's four, right? That's what I came up with.
New Jersey,
four states. You got Arizona, Montana, New Jersey, South Dakota. Arizona, same thing. You have to be 21 and older, and you can possess it and grow it.
Really?
Yes.
And grow it too.
And they also passed medical marijuana dispensaries, gave them approval to sell it as well to adults.
So like you said, people in Arizona are real happy right now.
Real happy right now. Well, they will be. These are going to take, for all these states, it's going to take probably, just like in Illinois, it's probably not really going to take effect until next year, mid next year probably.
Right, right. And Mississippi voters approved an initiative to establish a medical marijuana program for patients with debilitating conditions.
Now, that's right.
That's a little different, right?
It is a little different. Yeah, that one is different. And that's why I didn't include them in the four other ones. But yeah, the medical, let's see, Mississippi voters, they approved their ballot initiative, and that's going to allow patients with these, how you said it, debilitating medical conditions. And those, it's much like in Illinois, the health officials there in Mississippi are going to have to come up with, okay, which conditions are we going to approve it for? And that was a long process here in Illinois, and it changed, it developed, it modified over the year, the first year of their pilot program here. But and physicians are going to have to certify those medical conditions so before those patients can get some relief.
Right. So there's some red tape involved, perhaps.
Yes, yes.
Now, nationwide, what's the numbers nationwide? How many states have it? Do we have that as far as legalized marijuana?
Find it quickly. I don't have that one off the top.
11. 11 other states and the District of Columbia already allowed legal recreation marijuana use prior to Election Day.
Now, Illinois being one of them, yes.
Right. Now, I guess it's a matter of opinion. Do you see a possibility of a national stance on marijuana? Because it's all by the states right now.
Well, and that's a great question, too, because especially right now, the day you ask it, as we're talking about the election, because there's going to be a change in, or there could be, I should say, I don't want to get ahead of myself, there could be a change in the administration. So what does that do for this? Well, it's complicated, and I say that because the marijuana industry in the United States likes Biden because they feel like he can do some good things for states. But the thing with Biden as a senator, back in the 90s, mid-90s, he was for the crime bill that ended up sending tens of thousands of people to prison. And we're talking minor drug offenses to prison.
Right.
But when Biden was serving as President Obama's vice president, that administration issued the Cole memo. And that cleared the way for, legal marijuana businesses at the state level to operate without any problems from the feds.
Right.
It was just like, okay, we won't look. You go ahead and do it. We're not going to come after you. And so that is a good check in Biden's column for people who, support marijuana use and legalized marijuana use. And Biden, but here's where it gets complicated. Biden has already said, and so has his running mate, Senator Kamala Harris, they support, here's what they support. They support adults being able to use it without facing criminal charges. They support kind of tweaking the scheduling of the drug, and they support federal medicinal legalization. So that's a great thing for people who feel like marijuana, they could get some benefits from marijuana if they have these debilitating medical conditions. They want that legalized federally, but on the recreational use, they do not support federal legalization. They want the states to set their own laws, and they also support getting rid of criminal cannabis convictions. But the reason why it's difficult for the marijuana industry, the fact that they don't support the federal legalization, is because it's still widely, I'd say largely, a cash business, because these dispensaries cannot put their money into banks. Right. Because it's still federally illegal.
Okay.
So that is why it's complicated with under a Biden administration. It looks like it would probably remain federally illegal, and all of these businesses, at least for now, under the system now, cannot put their money into banks, and for fear of, you know, it being seized or, well, you know.
Right. That reminds me of an episode of Chicago PD. I think that was covered in one of those, right? It was. Big fan of the show.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it was, and there was a heist of them taking cash.
I love watching it for the scenes, but I don't watch every episode, but I love watching the scenes because you're like, oh, I've been there.
Very cool. Vic Vaughn, thank you so much for hanging out and straightening some things out. It's a complicated issue, and it's, you know, depending what happens with the election, it's only going to get more and more complicated, I think, right?
Yeah, it's going to remain complicated at least. But like we said, if for these some of these businesses and people who support it, especially for medical purposes, I think you're going to be happy if Biden wins, because it looks like they want to change a lot of things. Not the federally, they don't want to legalize it federally for recreational use, but they do want to do that for medical use.
Got it. Vic Vaughn, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And don't forget to put in the overtime, okay?
I'm filling it out now.
All right, sounds good. Phil Menicki for Dave Plyer. It's a Chicago guy who fronted one of the biggest bands of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and we're going to talk to him next. 720 WGN. His band has sold over 40 million records. He's written so many songs that we all know and love. He's the leader of REO Speedwagon, and he's one of Chicago's own, Kevin Cronin. Kevin, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Phil. How about you?
I am doing great. Let's get started right off the bat. Let's go back to the beginning for you, if you don't mind, okay?
Sure.
Let's talk about your influences. What got you to be the rock star that you are today?
Oh, man. My parents used to listen to a lot of Broadway musicals around the house, the soundtracks to South Pacific, My Fair Lady. My favorite was Bye Bye Birdie. But so my very first musical influences were that kind of music. And and the songwriting in those shows was was always telling a story, and there were musical themes that reoccurred, and I couldn't help but be influenced by that type of music. And then I started taking guitar lessons when I was about 11, and I didn't know why until one night, as I sat in the living room of our house down in Oak Lawn, just one of the southwest suburbs there in Chicago, and I turned on the Ed Sullivan Show, and there it was. The Beatles came on, and basically, you know, the picture tube exploded. My head definitely exploded, and I was like, that's what I want to do. And so I really owe it to a combination of Broadway shows and the Beatles. Go figure.
There you go. You were born in Evanston, right?
Born in Evanston, yep.
And then you went to...
And, you know, my dad was an identical twin, and he and my Uncle Bob were, you know, it was, you know, some twins end up being really close, and some twins end up kind of being opposites, and, you know, they looked identical. You literally couldn't tell them apart. And but I think my dad wanted to establish his own identity, so he kind of flew the coop, you know, left the rest of the Cronin clan up there in the Evanston Wilmette area, and he, you know, came down to the what was a brand new suburb of Oak Lawn back in the late 50s, and so I ended up being a South Side guy. You know, I grew up at the old Comiskey Park. You know, I was 8 years old when the White Sox, the Go-Go White Sox, won the pennant, and you know, I was literally number 11, Luis Aparicio. Every little league team I played on, not that I was any good, but he was my idol. And you know, my buddies and I would sit out in the left field hot dog stand, the field level hot dog stand, and talk to Minnie Minoso, you know, between innings. And you know, we were into it. You know, I was a proud White Sox fan, and you know, even though the Cubs are kind of, you know, they have the more nationwide appeal, you know, us White Sox fans, us lowly White Sox fans, you know, we stick together. And I was honored to be able to sing the national anthem at opening day a couple of years ago, and you know, had become friendly with Mr. Reinsdorf, who's a sweet, sweet guy. And so it was kind of nice to see my White Sox roots, you know, kind of come full circle.
I'm a Southsider myself. Go Sox!
Yeah.
Next year.
Yeah, my buddy Tony La Russa just got the gig back as manager. And, you know, I've become very friendly with Tony over the years. I've done a number of benefit shows for his ARFT Animal Rescue Foundation. And I can tell you that... Tony, on a personal level, you will not meet a more humble and yet more brilliant dude. I mean, the guy is just, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better human being than Tony La Russa.
That's awesome. Can't wait to see what's going to happen next year. Oh, my goodness. So much potential there, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right, so you're in Oak Lawn. You go to Brother Rice High School. Go Crusaders.
Yes.
You graduate there. You go on to Loyola, right?
Yes.
What were you studying at Loyola?
I was mostly studying the girls who had chosen to burn their bras and throw them in the Chicago River, that's what was going on in the world back then. So it was a little difficult to concentrate on what you were supposed to be in school for when there were, you know, anti-war demonstrations. I remember one day pretty much the entire student bodies of Loyola and Mundelein, you know, marched out and sat down in the middle of Sheridan Road, right there. You know, right at the curve there, yeah. You know, when Loyola and Mundelein are, and you know, stopped rush hour traffic in both directions. I mean, it was, you know, it was a crazy time to go away to college. I can tell you this, and you know, and as a freshman, I was, you know, I was the youngest. Me and my buddies were the youngest group there on campus, and. You know, we didn't know what was going on. The world was just being turned up on its side. You know, the 68th Democratic Convention in Chicago had started that ball rolling, and it was, you know, the anti-war movement was at a fever pitch. The college deferments had been ended, so college students were eligible to be sent off to Vietnam, and it was just a crazy time. It was, you know, we didn't understand what the war in Vietnam was about. And, you know, my father fought in World War II, and it was, you know, it was obvious that you know, that we were on the right side of history there, you know, to defeating the Nazis. But in Vietnam, it wasn't as clear, and so it was a very odd time to go away to school in 1969. I can tell you that.
Sure, sure. And you're in a band at this time?
Yeah, I was in a band, and so you know there was a lot of fodder for creativity, obviously, with everything that was going on in the world.
Sure.
You know, so many people were writing songs about the way we felt at that time. As far as creativity went, it was a good time to be an artist, for sure. Good time to be in a band. Music was everything to young people back then. And, I was really so fortunate to be in the right place at the right time. And, as I look back on my career, man, there are just so many lucky breaks that I got. And, those were the times. And I lived through it. As I said, it was a good time to be a creative person.
Sure, and it got you girls too, like, right?
Well, there was that. being in a band was something. You know, I remember it, you know, the exact moment when it happened, because I would walk to my guitar lesson at Rossi Music on 95th Street in Oak Lawn, and you know, this kind of puts it in perspective. So it's Saturday afternoon. I'm walking to my guitar lesson. A carload of what we used to call greasers pulls up, and just because I've got a guitar, they decide that they got nothing better to do than kick somebody's butt. And so there I was with a guitar. I was different. So I was, I'm like running through people's backyards, jumping fences, just trying to avoid getting beat up. That Sunday, the Beatles come on the Ed Sullivan Show. And by the end of that next week, those same guys that were chasing me through the alleys, trying to kick my butt, now were wanting to be in a band with me, because suddenly girls thought that guys with guitars were cool. And man, it happened just like that. It was literally overnight. I went from being the biggest dork in the neighborhood to being the coolest guy in school just because I happened to play the guitar.
Oh, that's funny. That's so funny. How did REO come about?
Well, I was in school. I was in my sophomore year at Loyola. I was living in a little apartment on Arthur Avenue up there, and the band kind of broke up. The band that I was in at the time, and so I needed a guitar player and a bass player, and I called the Chicago Sun-Times classified desk, wanting to place a want ad, which read, "Guitarist and bassist wanted for original music band." I'll never forget. That's what I wanted to say. And the woman on the other end of the line is like, "Well, no, we can't do that. You have to take out two separate classified ads for $15 a piece." And I'm like, "Where am I going to get that kind of money?" It's like, so I, again, just, you know, necessity being the mother of invention, I got the idea to form what I call the Musicians Referral Service.
All right, we want to hear more about that. Hang on, Kevin. We're going to find out more about the Musician Referral Service with Kevin Cronin. That's after we check in with the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here at 720 WGN.
Climb aboard. Let's
Yeah. It's 10:36, Phil Minnicking for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. All right, you created the Musicians Referral Service. It's kind of like a dating thing for musicians to get together. You got a response from a guitar player. And, Kevin, you're there. The name of that guitar player was?
The guitar player was the late, great Gary Richrath. Gary and I would join forces to, produce a number of hit albums for REO Speedwagon. We were kind of a creative engine for the band. We made a lot of popular music together, and but we also, as Keith Richards said in his book, Gary and I kind of fell into the same type of category as Jagger and Richards, and not to compare us to them in any way, but as far just the relationship. Keith Richards says, Mick and I have a love-hate relationship. He loves me and I hate him. And if you, it's baked into rock bands that the lead singers and the lead guitar players, they have that kind of love-hate relationship. You look at, Joe Perry and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith, Page and Plant and Led Zeppelin. I mean, the list goes on and on. A lot of times it comes down to the fact that the lead guitar players wish that they could sing, because if they could only sing, they wouldn't need that this lead singer to bug them all the time and hog all the attention. But Gary and I, we were more friends than rivals. And that creative tension in the relationship is responsible for for the sound of the band and the music that we came up with together.
Right. You tell the story of how that meeting went with Gary. You had a song and you played it for him, and then you played another song. Go ahead and recount that if you could for us, Kevin.
Well, yeah, I had just written my first kind of real song. And it was a song called Music Man, which we still play to this day when we play live.
Great song.
But when Gary came up to my apartment on Arthur Avenue to the world headquarters of the Musicians Referral Service, I mean, I thought sure he would see this and just go, I'm out of here. This is bunk. But Gary, he sensed something. So he asked me to sing a song for him. And the first song I sang for him was an album cut off Elton John's Madman Across the Water. And I assumed that no one had ever heard the song. It was a song called Holiday Inn. So I played this obscure album cut, and Richrath, his jaw dropped. He was like, dude, I can't believe you know that song. That's my favorite song on Mad Men Across the Water. I'm like, yeah, me too, so the fact that he and I both thought that we were the only ones who knew that song, and then of all the songs I could have chosen to play him that day, I chose that one. So it just goes to show how life is, man. It's like you just never know where life is going to take you. And if I've learned anything over my lifetime, it's just go with your gut. If I would have sat there and tried to think of, ooh, I wonder what song Gary Richrath of REO Speedwagon would like, I would have probably, there was any number of songs I could have chosen, but I chose the song that I liked, and because I figured, he's coming to see what I'm all about. I'm going to show him what I'm all about and give him, he's going to see who I am, see what kind of music I like, and we'll let the chips fall where they may. And sure enough, man, you know, that choice of that song, Holiday Inn, I think had a big impact on my getting the gig as lead singer of REO Speedline.
You talk about fate, right? Man, that's a great story. I love that story.
Yeah. It was, and as you're going through your life, you know, you're making decisions all the time, and so you're just, you know, making decisions, and it's not until you look back, which of course I've been doing now because I've been working on my memoir for the past almost 4 years now. But, you know, you look back, you see that there were certain decisions along the way that, man, if you would have, you know, gone left instead of right, or, you know, taken this train instead of that train, or whatever it happens to be,
sure,
how your life would have been so different. And again, you know, I just think that, you know, it really does come down to following your gut and just being yourself, and you know, and just trusting that will take you where you want to go.
Yeah, definitely. So you're in the band. You do one album, REO2. You leave the band. Well, on that album, first of all, Keep Pushing, I Believe Our Time Is Going to Come, incredible tunes, and you left the band. What happened there?
Well, thanks for the kind words about the songs. You could say, it depends on who you talk to. You know, if you talk to me, I would say that, basically, I was having vocal problems. I was diagnosed as having a nodule in my left vocal cord. And, you know, a nodule to a singer is, you know, is not good,
right,
to
right.
say the least. And since I was so new in the band, I was afraid to tell them what about this diagnosis. I went to the doctor in secret, and so I kind of took this twisted mindset that every time I sang at a rehearsal, that was one less time that I would be able to sing at a gig or in the studio. So I started not wanting to sing at rehearsals. And I started, you know, I started trying to save my voice by not talking. So it appeared to the band like I was kind of being a prima donna, you know, not wanting to sing a rehearsal, and that I was kind of, you know, being antisocial because I wasn't, you know, going out and hanging with everyone. Really, I was just trying to save my voice. And, you know, in retrospect, it would have been far more wise to just be out with it, be honest, and just be like, hey guys, you know, I just heard from the doctor that I'm supposed to be on voice rest, you know, and I tried to hide that, and you know, that was on me, you know, and I've learned another thing I've learned through trial and error, mostly error, is that, you know, it's always better to just be out with the truth, man. Just, you know, you just tell people how you feel, tell people what's going on in your life, and let the chips fall. So I ended up being, losing the gig in REO Speedwagon because hey, maybe if I would have told the truth, I would have lost the gig anyway.
Right.
But at least I would have lost it for the real reason. So, that was a tough one. That was tough to take. But
definitely,
you know, hey, it got me where I am today. I learned from my mistakes. You know, that's what it's about, man. It's about, you know, we're all making mistakes. We're all just, you know, in a bumper car, you know, going through life, and you just gotta pick yourself up. You know, you're going to fall, and it's how you pick yourself up that matters.
More with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon, Phil Menike for Dave Plyer. It's 10:46 on 720 WGN. Ten fifty. 720 WGN, Phil Manicki for Dave Plyer. We're with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. Okay, you leave the band. 4 years later, you are back with REO Speedwagon, right?
Yep. Hey, Phil, before I continue the story, can I just tell you how cool it is to me as a guy that grew up in Chicago? And, you know, my dad, God rest his soul, was an avid listener of WGN radio. So to be on the air in Chicago for me, it's just such an honor. It's just so amazing. You know, when I was a kid, I dreamed of being on the radio in Chicago someday, you know, and so I really appreciate this. But Kevin, no problem.
You're a rock star, okay? I'm a DJ, and I feel the same way. Like, my mother used to listen to WGN, and I'm right there with you. Thank you. Those are very kind words. Very true.
Yeah, it's right? Awesome, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
The radio is just the coolest thing. I mean, one of the main reasons that I was so inspired and so motivated to make records was because of, you know, driving around when I was in high school, hearing my favorite songs on the radio, and you know, the thought of having one of my songs on the radio someday, it was like such a fantastic dream that I never really thought would come true. But that was my motivation, and it kept me going, and it kept me, you know, when I got back into REO Speedwagon, I think we had both the band and myself, you know, I thought I was going to have a solo career, you know, because I used to play solo acoustic up and down Lincoln Avenue. I used to play at the old Earl of Old Town on Wells Street, the old Quiet Night. There were and still are, I'm sure, just so many great, venues for a young musician or a young songwriter to hone his craft. And Chicago is so, it's such a great place to come up, you know. It's a great place to learn, and the audiences in those clubs I used to play they'd be listening to the songs and listening to the words, and I would get the appropriate reaction, and I would learn from that, and so I gained a lot of confidence during the years that I was away from REO Speedwagon and playing solo. And so when the band called me to suggest that we, you know, give it another try, I came back in there with just a new sense of confidence. My voice was back, and like you say, I had written Keep Pushing, I had written Our Time Is Gonna Come. I had actually already written Time For Me To Fly at the time. And the band, so we both the band, you know, I came back with a sense of confidence, but also a sense of humility. And I think the band came back in the same way. We both had to deal with the fact that we needed each other. Mm. And, you know, no one likes to feel like they need one another. I think that's another aspect of the lead singer, lead guitarist, thing that is, man, I wish I didn't need that guy so much, you know, but you have to come to terms with that. And once you come to terms with the fact that you actually need other people, it takes the pressure off. It makes it easier to work with other people. It makes it easier to listen to other people, because we do, we need one another. We need to listen to one another. We need to listen to people who might not see things exactly how we do, because maybe when we take that those ideas into consideration, the sum of the of that energy is greater than either of the parts. And right. So REO Speedwagon and myself kind of reached that point right around 1977, and that's when things really started clicking for us, and you know, the next 10 years were just, it was a ride, that I never expected I would be on. You know, back when I was at Brother Rice High School, I don't think there were too many people who would have predicted that I was most likely to succeed. You know, quite the contrary, I would guess. But boy, that next 10 years was pretty amazing.
Oh, absolutely. The live album, by the way, the live album, the double live album, You Get What You Play For, I wore it out on 8-track, okay?
That's awesome.
As 9 out of 10 kids in Chicago did. I'm telling you right now, Kevin, it was unbelievable. In the car all the time. It was fantastic. Thank you for that. Okay. You mentioned Time for Me to Fly, that you had that written already. How did that come about? Was there an inspiration for that song? Who was it?
Well, yeah, there was, my first girlfriend, Susie L, who, as I referred her in the book, she and I, our relationship was hot and heavy. She was my first love, but it started losing a little steam, and so Time for Me to Fly was the song that when I kind of came to the realization that my first love had ended and it was time to move on. All these stories, there's so much more to them. And I guess that's why I'm writing the book, just to get into them a little deeper. But that song was big for me. It's the song literally has 3 chords. It's probably the simplest song I've ever written. And at the same time, to this day, when we're in concert, which hopefully we will be in concert at some point in the future.
Fingers crossed. Yep.
We're counting on. Yeah, we're counting on that. But man, when I walk out there and play those opening acoustic guitar chords on Time for Me to Fly, you can set your clock to it. I mean, people in the audience, that just gets them going, man. You hear the sound of, all these people's arm hair standing up on edge at the same time. And, people have got their lighters or cell phones, as the case may be, in the air. And man, I start singing and the whole audience is singing along with me. That's just a feeling. It's an indescribable feeling that I am so grateful to people all over, Chicago, the Midwest, all over the world that have allowed me because I remember that song when I was sitting in Boulder, Colorado, playing those chords and what the initial inspiration, and to have it come full circle and become this song that so many people have taken into their hearts and souls. It's the ultimate compliment as a songwriter. There are few feelings that reach that for me. So,
oh, that's got to be a great feeling.
I'm a very grateful person.
More with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. That's after an update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on 720 WGN. Nine minutes past 11 o'clock. Phil Manikian for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Back with REO Speedwagon's Kevin Cronin. How do you write a song? You've written so many great ones. Do you have a set process?
I really don't have a process. I mean, there's a general process that kind of goes like there's some initial inspiration. There's some just kind of burst of creativity that you, as a songwriter, you never know when it's going to hit. My good friend and an iconic Chicago musician, Jim Peterick, he and I talk about it, that You just got to be ready at any moment. You just got to be ready for that inspiration whenever it hits. And it can be in the middle of the night. It can be on an airplane. It can be in the car. You know, I've written songs in any and all of those places. And I think the crucial part, though, is capturing as much of that initial inspiration as you can in the moment. That's the mysterious part of songwriting. Then there's the crafting, where you take that initial inspiration and you actually have to finish the song. And I love that part of it too, because I love wordplay. I love finding that right word to express that feeling that you have. And writing to me is, I enjoy helping my kids with their essays, you know, when they ask me to. That's what I love to do.
That's not fair. That's an unfair advantage for your kids, because you write so well, I'm just saying. So you've sold over 40 million records, a lot of hit records, unbelievable songs, all those great albums. Do you have a favorite? I know that's a tough question.
Yeah, I know. It really is, man. It's kind of an impossible question to answer, because I've written a lot of songs over the years, and some of them have been good. Many of them have not been. Some of them have gone on to become big hits. Some of them, which I'm very proud of, have not become hits. So it's a difficult question. I think maybe if I had to pick one, it might be Roll With The Changes, just because that one is, it's kind of a story of my life in a lot of ways, because as we've been talking about during this whole conversation, you gotta be able to, pick yourself up when you fall down, and Roll With The Changes is kind of about that.
Let's talk about Ozark, season 3, episode 3. You mentioned Time For Me To Fly, a very pivotal song in this episode. How did that come about? Did they have that song in mind for the episode?
I think they did. I think that they, the Ozark is set in Missouri, so that's kind of the heart of REO Speedwagon country. So it kind of makes sense that our band would be the band they chose. And the song "Time For Me To Fly," if you see the episode and the couple of episodes leading up to episode 3, it really does make sense on a couple of levels. But it was a great experience. I can tell you that like most organizations, the vibes start at the top, and Jason Bateman and Laura Linney are just sweethearts. And the whole staff, the whole organization of Ozark, they just treated us so great. And one of the funny things was that I had a couple of lines in the episode, and so they handed me just a kind of a little printout just of our scene. And at the top of each page of the dialogue, it said Kevin Cronin was here. And they have gone out of their way, as I said, to make us feel comfortable from the moment we arrived on set. But I saw that, and I just thought, man, these people just really are—they're just going above and beyond the call of duty. So we did the scene, and Time For Me To Fly was just in the beginning of the episode. At the end of the episode, they called. They name dropped REO Speedwagon all these times. It couldn't have been better, And so then, a few months later, they filmed it, and we filmed it, I think, in September, and the show didn't drop until the following March. And so I'm sitting with my wife and kids, and we're kind of excited to watch this thing. And we had kind of watched episodes one or seasons one and two, so we're psyched, we're invested in the characters, we love the show, and all of a sudden we look in season three, episode three, the title of the episode, turns out that it was Kevin Cronin was here, which just, that just kind of blew my mind, you know, because...
How cool is that?
Know, that was just, again, yeah, it's you know, for that moment, my kids actually thought I was cool. So, you know.
Sold over 40 million records. Now you're cool because you're on their show. That's awesome.
Exactly. Exactly.
I gotta,
you know, I also, you just reminded me of a, you know, because, you know, so much of my life is wrapped up in the city of Chicago, the people of Chicago, Chicago radio, Chicago venues. But, you know, one of the moments that just the amazing career moments that I've had was back in the winter of 1981. I think it might have been March of 1981. We had a gig booked at the old International Amphitheater on the South Side. Mm-hmm. We had one show booked, and we hoped that we would come close to a sellout crowd. And then, in the meantime, Keep on Loving You was released and went to number one on Chicago radio. And suddenly, they added a second show. Then we ended up selling out four consecutive nights at the International Amphitheater. And on the second night, when we got back to our hotel, we were staying at the old Continental Plaza back in those days. We got back to our rooms, and there was a bottle of champagne in everybody's room with a note on the tray saying High Infidelity, number one on the Billboard charts. And so High Infidelity, our album, went to number one in the middle of this four-night stand at the International Amphitheater in Chicago. And it was just like, I just remember just sitting there, you know, and you flash back to, you know, playing at the old Ali Coffee House on 63rd and Pulaski, you know, at the, you know, all the funky gigs we played all over Chicago.
More with Kevin Cronin. He's with REO Speedwagon, of course, and that's next here. And 720 WGN. Well, we're back with Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. So it's March of 1981. High Infidelity is number one. You guys are on top of the world.
Yeah, it was just, it was surreal, is all I can tell you. It was, you know, as I said, Chicago, I've had so many surreal moments in Chicago. In 96, we had a song called Building the Bridge, which got somehow ended up on the desk of President Clinton at the time, and he related to it. And I don't know if you remember, but he would always talk about building the bridge for the 21st century. That
right.
It kind of became his catchphrase. And I was invited to join him, Mayor Daley at the time, and Senator Durbin, who was just a freshman senator in Illinois at the time. And President Clinton was up for reelection, and he had a huge rally in the shadow of the Picasso right there in downtown Chicago. And I remember walking out on, you know, so Mayor Daley gave a speech and Senator Durbin gave a speech, and then they introduced me, you know, I walk up there with an acoustic guitar, you know, I'm thinking, all right, I got to play a song that everyone's going to recognize, you know, so I play Take It on the Run, you know, because everybody knows Herbert from a Friend, Herbert from a Friend. So I play Take It on the Run, but the song that President Clinton wanted me to play was my song Building the Bridge.
Sure.
And so I played Building the Bridge, and you know, I walked down the stairs after my song, President Clinton is going to be up next to speak. I walked down the stairs, and here's the president. He gives me a big bear hug, and he's like, "Thanks, you know, thank you so much for being here," and he goes And I really love that song, you know, and it was just like, I'm going, wait a minute. I'm on stage in the shadow of the Picasso in downtown Chicago you know, with the president of the United States. It's just like, what? How did this happen? You know, what? You know, how did I end up in this, you know, having all these amazing experiences and have them be in my hometown? It's just, it's crazy. It's a surreal story, is what it is.
That's fantastic. What a great story.
And you know, one thing that I should mention is, you know, I was recently honored by Brother Rice High School. You know, on the 50-year anniversary of my high school graduation, and I came and I spoke. I asked, you know, the honor was being given to me, but I asked if part of it could be speaking to the student body. So I came in and gave a speech to the student body, and the point of my whole speech was kind of something that I touched on earlier, in that, like I say, no one would have mistaken me for being voted most likely to succeed when I was in high school. And my point to all these young men, you know, high school age men, was that, you know, you can do this. You know, your dreams can come true. Don't let anyone tell you that they can't. It doesn't matter what your dream is, you know, whether your dream is to be a famous musician, or if your dream is to be a fireman or whatever it is, you can do it. You just got to believe in yourself. You got to just keep picking yourself up every time you get knocked down. And, you know, I always say, you know, you get turned down by 99 possibilities, and you keep going because that 100th might be the one that where people get what you're trying to do. And, you know, that is really, I think, if I have anything to add to the conversation, it's that, you know, you can be the biggest dork in high school, and I was definitely I was in the top 10 in my high school, and you can end up, you know, where, you know, having all of your dreams come true, which mine have, and I'm thankful.
Inspirational stuff. A couple more things about Ozark. They refer to you as the Speedwagon. Nobody says that. It's REO. But I guess, I don't know, I guess some people. The guy was a dentist, though, right? So you got to keep that in mind, right?
Right. No, he goes, his line, I think, is, you know, we'll have our convention on the Missouri Bell, but you have to deliver the wagon. The wagon. Yeah. I got a phone call from my friend Tommy Shaw from Styx right after he saw that. And of the whole thing, that was what blew his mind. He just thought that was the funniest thing ever. And it really is.
That's,
you know,
funny.
The wagon. You're right. Who calls us the wagon?
There was a lot going on in that episode. There was a murder. There was a kidnapping. The FBI is involved.
Oh, yeah.
There's a hillbilly fist fight. And, oh, yeah, money laundering as well. Who played Dickie, your manager, in that? Was that Tom?
Yeah, I'm not sure who that guy was. He was not on set the same time that we were. But that almost caused me to pass on being part of the episode, was because, you know, they basically are the manager Dickie calls lead singer Kev to ask him if it's okay to launder $100,000 of cartel drug money through the REO Speedwagon merchandise and sound companies.
Right.
And in the episode, Kev says yes. And I'm like, so I'm talking to the producers on the phone, and I'm like, you don't understand, you know, Jason Bateman, his character is Marty Bird. You know, so when Marty Bird launders money, it's not Jason Bateman, it's Marty Bird.
Right.
But this is me. You're not, I don't have a pretend name here, you know?
That's funny.
And for a minute I was like, you know, for the sake of my kids, I don't know, it just kind of blew my mind at first. And then, you know, I kind of brushed up on some of the episodes. And once I got into it and started, like I say, falling in love with the characters and the story, I was like, all right, this is going to be fun. Right. I have nothing to fear.
And Dickie, by the way, is not credited. There's no credit Dickie as far as who that was. Just a side note. Because I looked. I was wondering who that was. Yeah. Yeah. All right, we got about a minute left. You've been mentioning a book. What's the story with the book? You've been writing it for a while, right?
Yeah, I started it by accident in Nottingham, England, in December of 2016. We just got to England. It had been a long year of touring. We toured with Def Leppard all summer. I'd been away from home too much, and the thought of a month of hotels being away from my family, it just kind of freaked me out. And so my default position when I'm having an emotional breakdown is I start writing, because then it helps me sort out my feelings. And I started writing that day, and I've been working on it. Not thinking that I was going to write a book. I was just trying to not freak out anymore. But it ended up becoming a little hobby. And then next thing I know, I was writing a book, and it's been 4 years, and I've been writing it ever since. I'm zeroing in on it. The title of the book, appropriately, is Roll with the Changes, My Life Within and Without REO Speedwagon. And we'll see what happens, you know. I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm almost done, and so we'll see what happens next. But it's very exciting, and if nothing else, my children will be able to read my life story.
There you go. We look forward to the book. We look forward to seeing you live, whenever that will be. I wish we had a crystal ball to know when that is, but when that time comes, we'll be there for you, Kev.
Yeah,
you have
I know,
us.
Man. I can't wait. I loved being home with my family, but I definitely miss being out there. And we'll be back in Chicago. REO Speedwagon will return. It's not a matter of if; it's only a matter of when. And I look forward to it. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Phil. An honor to be on the radio in Chicago. I love the city. I love the people. And we'll see you. As soon as possible.
And we look forward to that, Kevin. Thank you so much. Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. Continued success, my friend. Phil Manicki for Dave Plyer. It's off to the kitchen next. 720 WGN. Seven 36, Phil Manicki in for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Part of the song is Hey Julia as well. She's the executive food editor of the cookbook division and our favorite host on the TV show America's Test Kitchen. Welcome back to WGN, Julia Collin Davison. Julia, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Phil. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. You're no stranger to WGN. You've been part of the morning show here, right, on TV?
Yeah, I've been on a few times, and I also love coming to town and working with the local PBS station, doing events. We did one just last week or the week before, I think. We're doing them on Zoom now, of course, but
of course.
Hope to get back there in person soon.
That would be awesome. Tell us about America's Test Kitchen. For folks who don't know, what is it?
It is a magical place. It's like Willy Wonka land. It is located in downtown Boston in the Seaport District. And we produce food, not just food, but recipes specifically, and equipment tastings meant for cooking, and taste tests of products you find at the store. And so, we have two TV shows, America's Test Kitchen and the other one is Cook's Country. Now, they're both found on public television, and I just found out that America's Test Kitchen is the longest-running consecutive cooking show on TV ever.
Stop it.
We've been on for 20 years.
Wow.
And I was a baby when it started. And we just finished filming our 21st season, which was amazing, because we couldn't do it in the studio, obviously. So we did it in our own homes, which
wow.
is fascinating. So that'll come out next year. Cook's Country has been on for 14 years. We also produce magazines, two cooking magazines. One is called Cook's Illustrated, and the other is called Cook's Country. And what makes these magazines unique is they don't take any advertising. And so it's a subscription-based only, and, you know, without advertising, we're allowed to say what we really think about equipment and taste tests and so on. We also have an online cooking school that's killer. We have a number of YouTube shows, and we have an incredible website that kind of catalogs all the work we do. And then we have lots of podcasts, including one that is hosted by my co-host on TV. Her name's Bridget Lancaster, and that's called Poof. So lots going on. It's like food, media, and recipe development.
I have to tell you, the recipes, the instructions, the everything is just so easy and down to earth to follow. It is unbelievable. If you've never checked it out, you have to do it because it's just phenomenal.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, we take a lot of pride in how we develop and test and write recipes. We have a kitchen that's 15,000 square feet. We have 40 test cooks, kitchen helpers, and our goal is to make the best version of a recipe. And we do that by testing it over and over, sort of using the scientific method where you change one variable as you go. And then after we develop what we think is the best version of a recipe, we actually send it out to, I think we're up to over 60,000 home cooks all over the country that will make the recipe for this on their own time, on their own dime, and fill out a survey as to how the recipe worked and what they changed and if they need more instructions, better instructions, or photos to help them understand the instructions. And we take all that information to make sure the recipe really works in the hands of a home cook because, you know, like I said, 15,000 square foot kitchen with people helping with the prep and the dishes and all that and the shopping, we can make anything work. I mean, there's all clad in Le Creuset stacked to the ceiling. I mean, it is absolutely cook's candy land. So we can make anything work, but the value of a good recipe isn't whether we can make it. It's whether that recipe translates to the home cook. And so that's really a part we focus on pretty heavily. Right. And that's where the recipe, the equipment testing, and the ingredient taste testing. So not only will we test skillets and really put them through the ringer to tell you which one's really worth the money, but we'll taste, you know, canned chicken broth, right? And it's fascinating because we'll taste them straight. We'll taste them in soups and stews because you might notice a difference if you're just sipping it out of a cup. But does that difference really matter if you're putting it into a stew? Do those nuances of flavor show up or no? And canned broth, by the way, is absolutely fascinating because the bad broth, and there's so many out there, can make a really good soup taste like dishwater. And I've witnessed this. Whereas the can right next to it on the shelf will make a beautiful soup. So, of course, we publish all these taste tests in the magazine and they're on our website. So it's really just we want to help cooks be confident and creative in the kitchen.
You guys do a great job. We're talking with Julia Collin Davison of America's Test Kitchen. The science part, you touched on that briefly. That is so important, and it's so informative, but it's not overwhelming. Does that make sense? I mean, you guys hit a home run with that.
You know what? I struggle hard on those science graphics and the science bits we do on TV because I'm not a scientist. We have some incredible scientists on staff that walk us through. Well, for example, we'll say, well, the chicken tastes juicy when we do this, and it tastes dry when we do this, but I don't understand why. So the scientists will research it if they don't know it, come back with what happens, and then the scientists and I sit down and we try to put that in layman's terms. It takes me forever, but if I understand at the end and I can explain it, then I feel like we've done a good job. And understanding why things happen when you put something in the oven and it doesn't turn out is half the battle. Because once you understand a few basic whys, you have the freedom to just create food that you know will taste good because you know why you're doing what you're doing. So the science is really fun in America's Test Kitchen. And our other show, Cook's Country, we don't focus on the science as much as the story of food, the story of American people through the food they like to cook and eat and what's become popular in what city and why. And we did a story on the thin crust pizza of Chicago, which is like a little niche thing. It's just, you know, getting the story out of, and we did a carnitas. You know, what was the name of that restaurant in Chicago that does amazing carnitas? And you know, in the middle of Chicago, which you think is, you know, if you're not from Chicago, you think Chicago pizza.
Right.
But yeah, just telling the story of who moved where and why, and how that food helps tell the story and bring people together. So it's a slightly different angle on Cook's Country.
That's very cool. Let's talk about gadgets. I got about a minute in this segment, and I know we're going to go over, so if you could stick around. But just, what's your favorite kind of new gadget in the kitchen? What do you like?
My new electronic wine opener.
Really?
My favorite gadget this week. you know what? I'm a minimalist when it comes to, are you a gadget guy?
I am, yeah.
Are you? Okay, yeah, because only gadget guys ask, or gadget people ask that kind of question.
That's so true, right?
I'm a total minimalist. I do love the pressure cooker. Mm. I grew up with that. Do you have a pressure cooker? Or an Instant Pot?
I don't. I remember growing up, my mother had a one that was so thick, and mm-hmm. it had the thing on the top that spun around, and you were afraid it was going to fly off. So I'm
little hat, and the hat rocked back and forth.
Yes,
and
yes.
Depending on how vigorously the hat went back and forth, it noted what the pressure inside the pot was.
And I'm traumatized. It's going to fly off and whack me in the head. So no, I don't have one of those. No.
Well, so that's old school. The new school ones that still go on the stovetop have indicators that are much easier to read. But an Instapot or Instant Pot is essentially an electric pressure cooker, and it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it, because when the pressure cooker is on the stove, you really have to monitor the flame to assess how much pressure is in the pot. When you plug it in, it monitors itself, and it is the best. I pull it out pretty much every week to make chicken stock or chicken soup.
Very cool.
What did I make? Oh, I made beef and barley soup the other day in there. You know, it just, everything cooks so fast, and especially if you're making soups or stews, and you have bones in there, it pulls the flavor and the gelatin out of the bones in a way you just can't do in the oven. So I'm a big fan. What's your gadget of choice at the moment?
I'm going to tell you that after we take a quick break here, if that's okay.
Yeah. Suspense.
Julia Collin Davison of America's Test Kitchen. More in just a bit. 720 WGN. It's 11:49. 720 WGN. Phil Minnickian for Dave Plyer. We're talking gadgets with Julia Collin Davison of America's Test Kitchen. My favorite gadget right now, it's got to be the Weber Performer Grill.
So Weber, so it's a grill. Yeah. Is that... I don't know the performer. Is that an indoor grill or is it an outdoor grill?
It's outdoor. It's charcoal, but okay. You start it with gas.
Yes. Oh, you got the fancy one with the little table that's attached.
Love it.
Yeah, my dad has. I gave my dad one of those. They are good.
They are really good. Yeah, that's my favorite right now. Speaking of which.
Charcoal. So you're a charcoal griller.
100% charcoal. You got something for me?
Now, what kind of charcoal?
I'm kind of basic with that. I just go Kingsford.
You do briquettes. Okay.
Yeah.
Not hardwood.
No.
Gotcha.
No.
Briquettes are great, especially if you're able to light it without any fluid, obviously.
Yeah.
It tastes nasty. But the briquettes, they burn, long and even, whereas hardwood burns quick and hot. So, briquettes are really reliable. And you can kind of count the briquettes or measure them. You know, we actually, when we develop recipes for the grill, we measure briquettes by the quart. And so we'll say 6 quarts of briquettes or something
really?
Like that.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. All right. So you're right. That's really not a gadget. And
no.
I got to say, I said the Instant Pot, which is kind of a gadget. But if you like, and believe me, I've sat around the editorial table and talked about what defines a gadget versus a piece of equipment. And we both just blew the rule. Like, we didn't choose gadgets. We chose pieces of equipment. A gadget has to be, like, inexpensive, handheld, you know. And so when it comes to a gadget, my favorite gadget is the microplane zester or a rasp-style zester.
Really?
Absolutely. Do you have one of those?
I don't. I need to get one.
Holy cow, you don't have one of those?
No.
Oh, man, now I know what to get you for Christmas. So listen, rasp grater.
Yeah.
It's basically, you know, it's a rasp. It's a woodworking tool.
Right.
And it came popular in the kitchen 10, 20 years ago, maybe. And there was one brand on the market that had the patent. It was Microplane. The patent's up now, and so there's lots of different brands out there, and we've tested them all, but you still want to get the Microplane. We've put them in and out of Crocs 50 times, put them to the dishwasher. We had them tested with big hands, little hands, experienced cooks, inexperienced cooks. And Microplane, they have the right amount of teeth. The teeth are angled just right, and the depth of the teeth is just right. So you get zest and not piss. Great chocolate, it's the best way to do ginger.
Ooh.
You know what I do on it now? I do jalapenos because it makes a super fine mash, and so you get a really even burn and jalapeno flavor in a vinaigrette or a sauce. And, the new thing that I do is I buy pre-peeled garlic, you know, in those little packages, and the ones that always go bad before you can use them up unless you're making something super garlicky.
Right.
I put those in the freezer now. And so when I need garlic, I go in the freezer, I take a clove, and I do it on the rasp grater. And it's instantly minced garlic. It's so easy. And, you know, keeping in the freezer keeps those cloves from going bad. So, yeah, rasp grater all the way. Okay, I just, went on a love story with a rasp grater.
So now we know what Phil's going to get for Christmas.
What is your gadget?
I do have a mandolin. It's a mandolin, right? Kind of a similar thing. We call
it the
Widowmaker in our family because of that. Because one of the first times I used it, I got a little nick, and I'm like, okay, that's it. No more.
Oh, yeah. They're notorious for taking off fingertips.
Yeah.
But what are you making with the mandolin? That's pretty unusual. You making a lot of potato chips or?
Yeah. It was that. It was more of a, what's the word I'm looking for? It was, my sister gave me this recipe. It's fantastic. It's potatoes and cheese and beef broth. Oh.
Oh, like a gratin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds good. The beef broth.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It's really, really good. Make it all the time. But
nice.
I'm a little bit freaky with the mandolin. So.
Yeah. Oh, the other gadget that I think is a killer gift for yourself or someone else is a knife sharpener. People have just really dull knives and they don't know how to sharpen them. And learning how to sharpen a knife takes a lot of practice. And, you know, people have steels, but steels don't sharpen knives. They'll hone an already sharp blade, but they won't sharpen a dull blade. So an electric knife sharpener, I think our winner is called Chef's Choice, and it has two or three slots that you drag the knives through, and it brings them right back. And then you don't have to send the knives out to get sharpened, and it's so easy to do. You can just do them all one day, and then your knives are sharp for the, you know, the week or the month, depending on how much you cook. So that's another killer piece of equipment to own.
That's my pet peeve, not having sharp knives in the kitchen. I can't stand that. Oh.
Wait, so you sharpen your knives? How do you sharpen your knives?
I do, and I've got one of those. I don't know what the brand is, but it's got the two different things that you slide it through. One's coarse, one's fine.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I know. My husband has a belt sander and to do the knives, but it makes me so nervous.
Yeah.
Hello.
Can go flying off.
Talk about Widowmaker.
Hello. All right. We got about 2 minutes left. Let's talk quickly about Thanksgiving. I want to open with, on my grill, the way I do the turkey is I spatchcock it and put it on the grill.
Nice. Okay. Big question for you.
Yes.
Skin up or skin down on the grill?
I do up.
You do up. Okay. So it renders and it's on there and it gets nice and smoky.
Is that a good move?
Okay. Talk to me about how you prep your turkey ahead of time.
Besides cutting out
the backbone.
Usually get a brined one.
And then get a brined one.
Yeah. And then I cut it with, you know, shears and then just really butterfly it.
Perfect.
And put it on the grill because it takes so much less time than a full bird, right?
Yeah, it does. Well, brining was the key word I was looking for. And you said you buy a brine, which is perfect.
Yeah.
Most all kosher turkeys are brined, so that's another easy way to go. If you don't buy it brined, you can brine it yourself. That's just a salt water solution. And turkeys are big and, you know, refrigerator space can be tight, but you can always put it in like a cooler outside, especially in Chicago outside. It'll keep it nice and cold and you can brine it overnight that way. Sometimes you can add a little sugar to the brine, and that is especially nice on the grill because it helps get the skin nice and brown. But for grilling turkey, the brine is good because the alternate way of salting a turkey is to salt it overnight. So there's salting versus brining. Brine has the water. Salting is dry.
Right.
So brining, some people like it because it gets the meat evenly seasoned. But the downside is it makes the skin a little wet, which doesn't make the crispest skin. However, if you're going on the grill, I highly recommend what you're doing, which is the brine, because that water will obviously evaporate during cooking, but that water helps attract the smoke flavor into the turkey, so you'll get a smokier tasting bird, which is what you want if you're on the grill. So, yeah, it sounds perfect.
Very cool. So I'm doing something right.
And yeah. Now, talk to me about gravy, because if you're doing a grilled turkey, you're not having gravy. Do you make ahead gravy, which is my ace in the hole for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, definitely. The simpler, the better, right?
Right. Well, also, even if you're going to someone else's house and you show up with like a gallon of homemade gorgeous gravy, you're like a rock star. So that's just something you need to know.
All right, quick question. Do you stuff it or do you cook it separate?
No, cook it separate. Do not stuff the bird. You don't fit much in there. It ruins how you cook the bird. If you really want that turkey flavor on the stuffing, buy a couple extra turkey wings and cut them up and put them on top of the stuffing itself in the casserole dish. And you'll get that turkey-basted flavor, but you'll have a lot more stuffing.
Look at you. Nice touch.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right.
I got Thanksgiving down.
You definitely do.
Although for this year, you know, most people are going to probably have a smaller gathering around the table, which is unfortunate. So I think a lot of people are probably going to be doing turkey breasts, which is also really great. Because a turkey breast, you can just plunk right on top of a pan of stuffing and call it a day. And everyone gets white meat and you make gravy ahead and it's all good. So I think that's going to be another popular way to cook turkey this year.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us. Julia Collin-Davidson from America's Test Kitchen, getting ready for Thanksgiving. Thank you for joining us on 720 WGN.
Yeah, so nice to talk to you, Phil. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Julia. Thank you. Coming up next, he's a Hollywood screenwriter who started right here in Chicago. We're going to talk to him next. Nine minutes past midnight, Phil Minicky for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. He has written movies for Hollywood like The Cell, I Am Legend, Poseidon, and more. He's a Southwest Sider just like me. He's Mark Protasevich. Welcome to WGN, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm good, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Who would have known way back in, even before high school, we went to grade school together.
Yes, we did.
Who would know that we, both of us, would be on WGN in the year 2020, right?
I agree, and I was actually thinking about that today, and especially the neighborhood we grew up in, which was a very blue-collar neighborhood and very much a neighborhood of immigrants. My parents' grandparents, or my parents' parents, came from Lithuania and Russia, and so my parents were the first generation here, and that neighborhood was very much, you know, filled with, you know, my dad was an electrician. My mom was a Chicago public school teacher. You know, there were cops in the neighborhood, factory workers. And going into something creative was completely alien.
Right, right.
Or going into anything related to the arts or the media or something would have just been so strange for the majority of people in that area at the time. So I'm proud of both of us.
Yeah. Well, John F. Kennedy High School is where we went, southwest side of Chicago.
Yes.
You were brave enough to be on the speech team, the drama club. You were on the newspaper as well, the profile.
Yeah, I did a lot of writing for the newspaper, yeah.
You did a lot of that stuff that not too many people did. You were real brave to do that. I was just a swimmer, so I didn't even qualify as a jock. I wasn't a real jock. Because,
well, I would have to say that high school was a difficult time for me. I think like it is for any creative or artistic person, because you stand out. And at the time, you know, there were, I would say that at Kennedy, you were either fell into the jock category or you fell into what we used to call the burnout category.
I was just going to say that.
And so you were either kind of a druggy kid and on the fringes, or you were a really popular kid who played sports.
Right.
I tell my kids that it's so different today from the schools that they went to, that what we were at, it was, I don't know, two-thirds, maybe not that many, a third of the kids that were there didn't want to be in school. They just didn't want to be there, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, and there was almost a an anger or a hatred of anything different. And so,
yeah,
you know, I got bullied a lot in high school. There were a few kids there that I still remember their names that are, you know, etched into my psyche.
Right, right.
But I viewed it, you know, I remember I had really great and supportive teachers. I had a small core group of good friends who were interested in what I was interested in.
Right, right.
You know, movies and comic books and music and books and plays and you know, cultural things, artistic things. But, you know, there was a small group of us, so at least we had each other's backs. I think there are a lot of kids that don't have that kind of support. And it could still be difficult. It could still be, a hard time often, but I really enjoyed all of those things I did. I had a passion for drama and writing and art, and all of those things, you know, have an influence on movies and my writing. And so I was just happy to sort of get by. I sometimes refer to those high school years as, I think, you know, it was 4 years of doing my time. And then when I graduated and went to college, I went to Columbia College in Chicago, in downtown Chicago, and really fell in with a bunch of like-minded people. You know, this was a group of people who, you know, thought and felt and cared about the things I did. And that's where things really, you know, turned around for me.
Sure. A couple things about high school and actually before. Let's go way back. There's a story that I don't know if you'll remember. We were in grade school at the time, and we were playing softball at your house.
Oh, my gosh. I don't remember. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll remember, but I'm drawing a blank right now.
You lived on a corner house, and we were playing softball.
Oh, you know what? I think I'm going to remember.
It was in the intersection. And I was, like, playing the outfield, whatever, and somebody hit the ball, and I was running to get the ball, and I thought that the fire hydrant was over here, but it was right in front of me.
I remember that now, Phil. I remember you really hurt yourself.
Yeah. I went head over heels. One of my knees was bigger than the softball because of the swelling and whatever. The other one was bad, and we had to call my mom, and we went to the hospital. We had it drained, and like, I don't know how long after that, I don't know, 3 years after that, I had arthroscopic surgery when arthroscopic surgery was like this new thing. It was really, really weird. And that happened at your house. I'm not blaming you. Don't get me wrong.
You know what I remember from that moment is that my mom really was a champ.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That she really really took control of the situation. I remember her calling your mom,
yep,
and who I remember being a terrific person. I want you to know, I really have fond memories of your mom.
As you and your mom and dad too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and but oh God, no, I do remember that. Yeah, it was pretty serious. It was one of those eye opener kind of, you know, everything's going fine and everybody's having fun, and then something really serious happened.
And I remember rolling around, and I'm pretty sure it was your mom that said, "Just stay still,
yeah,
and be okay." So, yeah, that's the first thing. Now, earlier in the show, we had Kevin Cronin on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he went to Brother Rice.
I didn't know that.
And he brought up the fact that he was considered a nerd because he was in music. You know,
right.
He was in a band and this and that, and he was probably not on the list of most likely to succeed. But look at him now, and
right.
I think I can put us both in the nerd situation.
Oh, definitely. I certainly was.
Right?
But, I certainly was.
But
yes.
Again, and Kevin was so appreciative to be on WGN Radio, as I know I am, and I'm pretty sure you are too. So
yeah.
That's our kumbaya moment. There we go. All right?
Sounds good.
Thank you for sharing that. All right. So you go to Columbia College.
Yes.
Okay. What got you into writing? Who were your influences? Why did you go that path?
Well, and this will be some great Chicago lore for people, and I'm sure some people listening will remember. I can honestly say that one of the greatest influences on me and what happened to me and how I chose my career was because of Creature Features on WGN
awesome
television when I was growing up on Saturday nights. And also, I would have to say, and I remember Screaming Yellow Theater,
yeah,
with the original Svengoolie.
Wow.
Back then. But those old Universal horror movies that used to play on Creature Features were just so mesmerizing for me. And this was when I was probably about 12 years old. And my mom would let me stay up late and watch them. And half the time I would fall asleep before they were over. But I just became obsessed with those movies. And that led me into loving movies in general. And I would freely admit that even though I was a pretty good reader, I definitely read my share of books in those days. I was probably reading more comic books and watching more movies, though.
Right, right.
Comic books were a big part of my life. And growing up, at one time, I thought about becoming a comic book writer and illustrator. And then I had done a lot of acting when I was a kid, and thought about that for a while too. But I took a film class in high school. I remember Mr. Gaywell. Do you remember him?
Yes, I do. I do.
And it was the one film class,
right,
that was taught in the school, and it was film history. And you could also make Super 8 movies, which is the first movie I ever made was for my junior year of high school film studies class.
Hold on one second. I want to hear more about that. We got to take a break. We'll be back with Mark Protasevich talking about Chicago and high school and how he became the great writer that he is. It's all on 720 WGN. 1222 on 720 WGN. Phil Minicky for Dave Plyer. All right, we're back in high school with Hollywood screenwriter Mark Protasevich. Kennedy High School on the southwest side of Chicago. That's where you got your start, right?
Our high school offered one film studies class, and a lot of it was watching movies and talking about them and sort of looking at movies in a more critical manner than just simply watching them as pieces of entertainment. And also, you had the opportunity and equipment to make short Super 8 movies. And they had the equipment there that I got to borrow and use, and I made my first film in my junior year of high school, and I really caught the bug. I felt that film started to encompass everything that I loved. It involved acting or working with actors. It involved art in terms of the look and design of a movie. It involved music, because music's a key component of film, and it was, of course, involved writing. And so all of these things that I really cared about were key components of this one medium. And from that moment on, really, when I took that class, it was like I knew I wanted to have a career in film.
So what was the movie? What was the title of the movie? What was it about?
I remember it vividly. It was a stop-motion animation movie called iRobot. And it was set to the music of the Alan Parsons Project, iRobot album.
Wow.
Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do.
And it was about a human who is enslaved by robots, and he escapes, and a robot tracks him down because he's a fugitive, and they end up both dying before the human can escape.
Wow. And you did this as a junior in high school.
I was a junior in high school.
Damn.
And I'm building these elaborate miniature sets on the ping pong table of our basement, driving my father crazy because he couldn't play ping pong and I was making a huge mess. And it was all very crude stop motion animation. I'm making it sound like this grand concept, but it was all of about 6 minutes long. But I remember my classmates just being awed by it, you know, because it was just so strange for them that somebody would go and make something that even attempted to look like this.
Right. Wow.
But that's, yeah, I caught the bug, and that was...
Do you still have that?
I do.
No
I do.
Way.
It's in storage somewhere, and it's still on Super 8.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'd have to get a Super 8 projector. I lost that a long time ago.
Very cool. So you're at Columbia College. You get the bug. You're studying. Where do you go from there? You graduate from Columbia.
Well, I graduated from Columbia with a real focus on screenwriting, and wrote a couple of feature scripts while I was in school. And then the Columbia actually asked me to teach after I graduated a couple of the beginning production courses, what they used to call Film Tech 1. And so I actually ended up teaching there a few courses a year for 4 years. And also in that time did some freelance writing and made a short film that actually won a couple of awards at the Chicago International Film Festival. And then I decided I really needed to change. I really needed to challenge myself and made the decision to move out to L.A. I had just broken up with my girlfriend who I'd been living with, too, so that played another role in it, as those things often can.
They do.
But I remember packing up my car. I remember selling everything, pretty much everything I owned. I had about $5,000 in my name and drove out to L.A. in my Ford Escort and stayed on the couch of some very wonderful friends of mine. I told them I would probably be there for a couple of weeks and ended up staying a couple of months until I got a job. And, of course, I went out with the intention of establishing myself as a screenwriter and had a screenplay ready to show as a sample, but I didn't, you know, I was broke. I needed a job. I couldn't sit back and have a trust fund or anything like that. That wasn't my background.
Right,
So while I was trying to establish myself as a writer, I took a job. My first real big film industry job was as a receptionist at Michael Douglas's production company.
Really?
Yeah, which I got by answering an ad in the Hollywood Reporter. And that led to a job as a reader or a story analyst, what they call a reader, where you analyze people's scripts and write up a summary of them and then give your thoughts on them.
Okay.
And so actually my training at Columbia College
was right up your alley.
Writing about film helped me prepare for that job. So you're evaluating it and you get, you know, and if you're a good, you had to have good writing skills to be able to do this and also good analytical skills. So I worked as a reader for a couple of years for a producer, Scott Rudin, who actually became incredibly successful and powerful. And then I worked at Columbia Pictures as a reader and got promoted there to what they call a development executive or a creative executive, which is, I always describe it as the equivalent of being like a junior editor at a publishing company. You know, you're looking for material and you're working with writers, developing projects. And I did that kind of work, eventually working my way up to vice president of development at MGM 6 years later, 6-7 years later. And I worked for a variety of places, for a producer at Disney, at Orion Pictures, if people remember Orion.
Yeah.
Great, great studio.
Yeah.
At the time, this was during the time they were doing Silence of the Lambs and Dances with Wolves. So I was doing that type of work, but ultimately it was unsatisfying for me because of what I wanted to be doing was writing. And I had written the entire 6-7 years I was doing that development work, working as an executive, I wrote at least a script a year in the hopes that that script would be the thing that changed the course of my life.
Wow.
But it wasn't until I wrote the script for The Cell that I got an agent and sold the script and was able to leave that work, and I've been working as a writer ever since.
More with Hollywood screenwriter Mark Protasevich. That's after this update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom at 720 WGN. It's 12:37, Filmaniki for Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. Back with Hollywood screenwriter Mark Protasevich, who wrote the movie The Cell. How did that come about?
I had been working in development for a while and really wanted to challenge myself to write something that could really be my calling card, or I was going to give up on the idea of trying to establish myself as a writer and just solely devote myself to being a good executive or producer and working with other people, because it had been frustrating for me, because I had written about 6 or 7 scripts that came close to getting me an agent or came close to being bought, but never happened.
Right, right.
And so I found myself in this situation where I kind of just bet everything on The Cell. And I sat and I wrote it devotedly. And it was really, I was really going through a fascination with serial killers at the time. But also I really loved the idea of going into someone else's mind. There had been a few movies that dealt with sort of being able to participate in people's dreams. There was a movie called Dreamscape. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember. There were a couple of Star Trek episodes that dealt with the same kind of idea. And so I combined those two elements, the idea of going into someone's imagination and a serial killer story. And it was really the first time I think that I had written something where I felt this could be it. This could be the thing that changes things. And a woman I used to work with, her husband was an agent, and I sent it to him, and he flipped for it, and then we sold it, and everything changed.
That is, if you've seen the movie, there's a lot of stuff going on there.
Yes, there is. It's a very strange movie.
And this was your first.
I'm a very normal person, but the stuff I write can be very strange.
How does that work?
I don't know. I often used to joke with people that there's probably somebody out there who writes sweet, cuddly, fun children's books, but in their real life, they're a very dark, twisted person, and I'm just the opposite.
I kid. Okay. About The Cell, Jennifer Lopez, Vince Vaughn. Vincent was incredible in that movie. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Roger Ebert flipped for it. He, in fact, called it one of the 10 best movies of the year 2000. And
yes,
you
he
wrote
did.
It.
That was a great beginning. You know, I remember actually being at a friend's house in California and telling him, oh, my, Sneak Previews is going to be on, or what did they call it? It used to be Sneak Previews, and then it became something at the movies.
At the movies, yeah. They were in the balcony the whole night.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I'm watching this with my friend at his place, and I've just, my jaw dropped because the review was just so positive. And then Sometimes review, of course. Yeah. Ebert was Sometimes, yeah. And the review, and then when it got on the 10 best list, and so he was a real champion of it and really flipped for it and was supportive of it. At the time, however, though, and the movie was successful, it did do well, but at the time, other critics were not on the bandwagon and, you know, called it derivative or too much. The director, Tarsem Singh, they said, oh, he's an MTV video guy and blah, blah, blah. And so some of the reviews at the time were rather negative. What's interesting is that now the movie has really developed a devoted cult following.
Sure.
And it's sort of been reevaluated. And there's even stuff, you know, you can look up online about how it was really kind of neglected at the time and misunderstood and way ahead of its time. And all that's great, because I used to love cult movies. I used to love being a fan of movies that were not, you know, not hits or critical successes when they first came out, but years later people realize are really something special. So
right.
I'm happy about that.
You mentioned the box office. It was a $33 million budget, but it made $104 million at the box office.
Yeah, I remember talking to Mike DeLuca, who was the head of New Line at the time, saying that, you know, they were incredibly pleased with the results.
And it was an Academy Award nominee for Best Makeup as well.
Yep.
And
deservedly.
You
should have gotten probably nominated for costume design too, but production design. But
All those were incredible. You were the co-producer on that as well. How did that come about? When you're the writer,
well, it was because it was an original screenplay. And when initially the script was at MGM, and then they put it into what's called turnaround, where they decide they're not going to make it, and you have a small window of opportunity to try to get another studio interested, and that studio then has to reimburse MGM for the money they've spent on the script already. And luckily, Mike DeLuca and Donna Langley, who is still currently president of Universal, but she was a young executive at New Line at the time, and she was a real champion for it, really loved the script. And New Line bought it, and because of the turnaround, and there had been no producer involved when I first sold the script, I essentially had complete control of the script. And,
wow.
And who would buy it, and so I made my agent negotiated for me to become a co-producer on that.
Got it.
So I would have some say in, you know, the choice of director and the casting and that type of thing, or at least they would consult me. Whether they would listen to me, I don't know.
Got it. So about the casting, I read this and I think this is hysterical. The woman who was being tortured in the water chamber and everything.
Yes.
Tara, is it Subkoff? Is it?
Yes, I believe so, yes.
She said she was a lifeguard, and she got the part, but she couldn't go underwater without holding her nose.
Right.
It's kind of a problem.
Yes, it was a problem. So, I think that actually became quite an issue on the set. So.
Right, because it was too late to change.
Yeah.
And I read that, and I'm like, are you kidding me?
I know. I think she was a little, maybe a little less than completely truthful in her.
She wanted the part.
Right. She wanted the part.
Now, we mentioned Roger Ebert before that. Did you get to know Roger at all?
I didn't get to know him at all. I didn't at all. I sent him a fan letter thanking him for his review, but we never made any kind of contact. I've since become friends with someone who knew him quite well, but I wish we had.
Yeah, very good. So that was a hell of an introduction, just the scope of that movie and everything. That was your first film. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was. And what happens when you first sell your script, it took a while for the sell to get made, but it eventually did. But what happens when you first sell something and it becomes, you know, it's written about and it's published in Variety and Hollywood, so people are aware that you've sold something and they want to, and what your agent then does is use that script as a sample to send to studios and producers around town to then try to get you more work that they have projects. Most of a screenwriter's work is not writing original screenplays. It's being hired to write scripts by studios or producers that they have, you know, they have projects in the works and they need someone to write them. So you sort of enter this group where you're available for work.
Got it. Hold on there one sec, Mark.
We've
got to take another break.
Okay.
I want to hear more about that and your process of writing. We're with Mark Protasevich on 720 WGN. It's 7:20 WGN, Phil Minnickin for Dave Plyer. We're talking with Hollywood screenwriter Mark Protasevich. He's a Southwest Sider as well, just like me. How do you write a movie? What is your process?
Well, every project is different. And, you know, the cell was an original script, you know, completely from my imagination. But the next big project that I work on that I got the opportunity to write because the executives at Warner Brothers loved the script of The Cell, I got to write I Am Legend. And I was involved with I Am Legend for years. That's a whole other long story. But so that's a situation where I knew I was a big fan of The Omega Man with Charlton Heston. I had read the Richard Matheson book. I was familiar. There's another adaptation with Vincent Price called The Last Man on Earth. And I was familiar with all of those. But Warner Brothers wanted to do a big movie. And so, you know, a big different kind of version of it. So that's what eventually became I Am Legend. But every project is different. So that's I Am Legend's a situation where I'm adapting existing material. You know, there had been two other movies made. There's an existing book. So you're trying to come up with your own interpretation of stuff that's already been, of material that's already been done by other people.
Okay, A, that's very gutsy. And B, you are definitely going to get some negatives from that. Yes?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, there are still people to this day who want a version of I Am Legend that's essentially a very faithful adaptation of the Richard Matheson book. And I love that book, but if you read it, so much of it is just is stuff inside the main character's head. It would be very difficult, and I think I don't know how unique it would be in a big movie marketplace. It would probably be a smaller movie. And actually, the Italian producer Vincent Price version is the closest to the book. So yeah, you're always going to get people who question your choices. And really, all you can do is just let that roll off your back. I don't think, I mean, with the internet, it's gotten even worse. I mean, I don't even read comment sections.
Yeah, you
about
can't.
Anything that I've worked on. I just avoid that completely. But like I said, every project is different. And sometimes it's like trying to figure out a puzzle. You're trying to put all these pieces together. My favorite type of project, though, is one where it almost just seems like a gift, where I just really feel like the movie exists in my head, and all I have to do is take dictation.
Right, right.
So that's when I know I'm really working on all cylinders, is when I see it so clearly, where it's almost like it already exists, and so I'm just describing what I'm seeing in my head. Other times it can be more difficult. Sometimes, I did a lot of rewriting
right. When
I first started. I don't like doing that so much right now. It just feels funny because I like being the first person on a project. I often equate it with screenwriters are like pitchers, and I always want to be the starter who thinks he's going to pitch a perfect game.
right.
But most of the time you get replaced, you know, in the sixth or seventh.
Well, and what about that?
But other people are closers. They specifically come in and work on other people's scripts.
Right. And as long as you go into it with that understanding, you're going to be okay, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, because the thing is, there's a lot of disappointment in this job. A lot.
Yeah.
Mainly because for every... Let's say, in the last 20 years, I've written 20 scripts. 5 have been made. I've been paid for those 15 others.
Right. Well,
great. You're paid that thanks to the Writers Guild. You get a definite fee. You get a bonus if the movie gets made, of course, but you're getting the majority of your fee is up front. So you can make a very good living and actually not have anything done. I know a screenwriter who's worked for 25, 30 years steadily and has had one movie made.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's that's the frustration. It's just it can be frustrating. But
I can imagine. You mentioned
you always think the next one is going to be the perfect experience,
right? You mentioned you don't read reviews. Do you go to premieres?
Well, I mean, I read reviews, but I don't read comment sections.
Got it. Do you go to the premieres of the movies that you've done?
Oh yeah, I've been to every one.
Cool. Do you rewatch those movies?
I will. I recently watched The Cell again for the first time in maybe 10, 15 years because it was the 20th anniversary of its release. So I did a couple of interviews about it. I watched it in preparation for the interview, and I was really pleased.
Yeah, you should be.
I was really pleased. And actually, I would have to say, you know, I Am Legend, you know, will pop up on cable or TV fairly often. Thank you, residuals. I'll watch some of it. Yeah. I'll watch some of it.
We got about a minute left.
Sure.
What's next for Mark Protasevich? What are you working on? Can you talk about
that? Well, during the whole COVID crisis, and I was at home. And my wife's a painter, so she's, you know, was in her studio working, and I'm in my office. And what I decided to do, I had often been approached in the past about doing a television series, but was concentrating on features. So for the last, 6 months, I've been developing a TV series, which would be the first thing I ever did in that world.
You could tell us more, but you'd have to kill us, so we won't have
yes,
that happen.
Exactly.
Best of luck with that. Congratulations on a fantastic career so far. You keep up the good work.
Thanks, Phil.
One of Chicago's own, Mark Protasevich. Thank you for joining us, buddy. We appreciate it.
It was great talking to you, Phil.
Great talking to you too, Mark. Hollywood screenwriter Mark Protasevich. Thank you, sir. Thanks to our other guests tonight as well, Julia Carlin Davidson of America's Test Kitchen, Kevin Cronin of REO Speedwagon. Thanks to my producer tonight, Brendan Rook. He did a lot of pre-production work as well. Ashley Byhun, Curtis Koch as well. Thanks to our engineer this evening, Dan Long, Jim Foster as well for some ideas. And a huge thank you, of course, to Dave Plyer for letting me fill in. Dave is back next week. Don't forget about Dave's show, The Sinatra Hours. That's right here, Sunday mornings, 6:30 to 9 on 720 WGN. I hope we made you smile with our conversations tonight. I really do. If we did, please let the powers that be here at WGN know that. I would really, really appreciate that. Thank you for being here with us. It's always great to talk to you on the radio. Thanks for all your kind words as well. Be safe. Look after the ones you love. Okay? I'm Phil Menicky. Up next, an update from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. That's here at 720 WGN.